We're going to continue with the marvelous Samanyapala Sutta. And Samanyapala means the fruits of the ascetic life. And it's this very interesting sutta because the backdrop to the sutta is very interesting, but also the content is also very interesting here. And the backdrop to the sutta is this King Ajatasattu, who has killed his father, King Bimbisara, who was like the previous king of Magadha. And he has a lot of remorse, and he feels terrible about this. So this meeting with the Buddha is trying to kind of overcome his remorse. This is kind of the purpose of this meeting here. And then he asked the Buddha, well, what are the fruits of the ascetic life? What's the point of being a monk or a nun or practicing the Dhamma or whatever? What's the point of this? And so this is kind of very interesting. It comes to the very core of what Buddhism is about in that sense. And in the process of answering this question, the Buddha then gives the whole gradual training. And remember, the gradual training is this idea of how we move from the very beginning when we start out to the very end of the path, stage by stage. And each one of us is somewhere on that path. Yeah. So you, hopefully, as we go through this, you will recognize, okay, this is where I am. Or it's not really quite as precise as that, because the truth, of course, is that we develop the basic factors all along. And then the higher factors get weaker and weaker the higher we go up. That's usually how it is for most people. And so the Buddha has just started giving this gradual teaching. And it starts off with a Buddha arising in the world, the realized one arises in the world. You can probably see that on the screen there. And then the Buddha gives this nice expression for what a Buddha actually is. How we should remember the Buddha, how we should recollect the Buddha. This is really what this is about. And this is the famous Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno, etc., which you can see right there. And this is the way the Buddha says that we should recollect him. This is the kind of the beginning here of the whole path. You meet the Buddha, you meet someone special, and these are the specific qualities that you should expect to see in someone like the Buddha. And so this is very, very interesting, because if we want to develop some kind of relationship with the Buddha, taking the Buddha as a real teacher, it is very useful to understand what this formula is about. It's a very powerful formula. This is how the Buddha said, this is how you should think about me. And one of the things that comes out of this formula, when you look at it, there is nothing there which is supernatural. There's nothing about flying through the air or reading the thoughts of others. And so these things, the Buddha, it looks like from the sutta that he could do those things, but they are not essential. They're not the core. They're not really what the Buddha is about. These are side issues. And you will always find that in the large part of the Buddhist world, these are the sort of things that are often emphasized. They are about the Buddha. The more miraculous he is, the more marvelous the Buddha is, and people gain faith, but it's not actually the wrong kind of faith, because this is the right kind of faith. It's not about miracles and marvelous things. It's about something very different. It's about wisdom. It's about understanding. It's about having the ability to be a teacher for humanity. So what comes out of this, and this is what I was focusing on last time when we had this particular, the first session on this. So this is the second session now. I think it's the second one. I'm not entirely, I think it's the second one. And I was focusing on the idea of the Buddha to be, the Buddha before his awakening, how he is a human being, and how, in that sense, before his awakening, he's really just like us. Yes, he has especially powerful spiritual faculties, but basically he's like us. And when the more you read the suttas, the more you read those suttas that talk about what the Buddha talks about himself before his awakening, he always comes back to these problems that he had. So in one sutta he talks about having wrong view before his awakening. I too thought that happiness was to be had through pain. This was one of the wrong views. He says specifically, before my awakening, Prince Bodhi, or Prince, this is the Bodhiraja Kumara Sutta, Majjhima 85, before my awakening, Prince, I too thought that happiness was to be gained through pain. This was the standard view in India at the time, and it was wrong. He had wrong view. You go to the Dvidavitaka Sutta, Majjhima 19, and he says he has all these defilements. This is how I overcame my defilements before my awakening here. You go to the Bhayabhairava Sutta, Majjhima 4, and he talks about being fearful in the forest. Overcoming fear. This is like us, right? If you go into the dark forest at night and you hear a twig, whether you hear someone walking along, it's just a kangaroo. Okay, I can relax. But it's when it's really pitch black and you hear unfamiliar sounds, and the sounds get magnified in the forest at night, right? They get so loud. It can be sometimes a bit scary, especially if you're all by yourself. If you're in like Bodhinyana Monastery, it's not frightening at all because there's people around, it's really easy. But if you're far away in the forest, and so you see these things again and again and again in this sutta that talk about the Buddha, how he had very similar problems that we have. He talks about being attached to his wife and children, to the things that he owned, and how he had to give up those attachments. And this is a very important part of understanding the Buddha. He was human, and because he is human, that is precisely why his teachings are so relevant to us. That is why the Buddha's own life is relevant to us. Because he has experienced the same thing. He understands us because he's one of us. And this is why what makes Buddhism so different from any other religion. It is about a human being teaching another human being. And there's no religion like that in the world. Almost all other religions are about God, some kind of thing beyond nature which teaches us. And this is what one of the many things that makes Buddhism kind of really special and really powerful. So this is the first thing. It's not about miracles and marvelous things. So this was my emphasis last time. So I talked about accomplished in knowledge and conduct, vidya charana sampanno. You can probably see it over there. So that was part of that. And then we come to this next word. After that, we have the word holy. Yes, the Buddha is holy, according to this translation. I take no responsibility for this translation. This is not mine. This is Bhante Sujato. So if you disagree, write to him. You're not going to get anywhere, but you can write to him anyway if you like. What is this holy? What does this mean? Sugato. What does that mean? And Sugato is one of those very well-known epithets of the Buddha. This is kind of how he is known. And sometimes when people speak to the Buddha, they will actually call him Sugato. They will use Bhagava, Sugato. These are the kind of words that are used to address the Buddha in the suttas. And what it really means, the word is kind of divided into two things, Sugato. It has the Su. If you want, you can highlight those words when I say them, Shamari, if you want to. You don't know what to do? If you can, I'm not sure. And if you can't, that's okay. But that's what I like to do if I control the keyboard. But, don't worry too much. So the idea of Sugato is two words there, Su and Gato. And Gato means gone. And Su means like well. Su is a positive prefix. So it means something like well gone. That's the idea of Sugato. In the suttas, the idea of when someone is Sugato, it usually refers to a good rebirth. You are well gone to a good destination, gone to a good rebirth in the future. But here, obviously, it doesn't mean that, because the Buddha is not going to be reborn, nor is he reborn now. Technical problems. Is it all right? Okay. Yeah. And so for the Buddha, the idea of well gone means he is well gone in this life, because this is the only life, you're well gone. So the Buddha has kind of achieved the highest kind of happiness, and he's achieved the highest potential for human beings right here in this life. So I think Sugato could be translated something as happy, someone who's truly happy or something like that. He's gone to a good destination right here now. Good destination means you are happy, obviously. So that might be one word. But because it is an epithet, you can read. the downside, yeah, the negative side of things. And then you have the Nisarana. Nisarana means the escape. And so the Buddha analyzes everything in the world according to these three things. Yeah, the pleasant aspect of things, the gratification of something, the downside of something. And then once you understand that the downside is far worse than the gratification, okay, then you let go and you escape from those things. And this is a very important triad, because very often in Buddhism, if we focus too much on suffering, well, why is it that people do all of these things in the world? And the answer, of course, is that many things, they have a pleasant side to them. And we are often blind to the negative side because we don't see the negative side. We are trapped by the pleasant side, and so we don't seek the escape. And so a very large part of the Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice is to train your perception and your views, your understanding of reality, so you see the downside of things in the world. Yeah, you understand the negative side. We are very good at seeing the good sides. Yeah, yay, what a wonderful nice meal, or nice new car, hooray, and promotion at work, or a nice relationship, or whatever. We see why these things, everyone sees why these things are happy. Yeah, you don't have to be very, very sharp to see that. But to see the downside of those things, well, that actually is the hard part. And that is where so much of the training on the Buddhist path is. And so the idea of changing our perceptions, developing your perceptions, seeing the world in a new way, a way that aligns with the way the Buddha sees things, well, that is really what this is about. Loka vidu, understanding the world fully, has these three characteristics, and you need to then weigh up the good side with the negative side. Okay, I'm going to go for the escape, because this is no good. That is kind of what this amounts to. But there is another way of thinking about this, because we know that in Buddhism, the world is really just the world of personal experience. World out there, does it really make sense to talk about the world out there? Maybe, maybe not. But really our world, each one of our world, is the world we experience at all times, right? Yeah, right now, your world is what you experience. My world is what I experience. Yeah, each one of us, we experience the world. That is our world. And it is in that world that we experience happiness and suffering. So one way of thinking about loka vidu here is that the Buddha has a full understanding of all possible experiences that can be had by any kind of being, including human beings, animals, or whatever. So he has a full scope of understanding, down to the kind of lowest terrible realm, to the highest kind of sublime realm of that lasts for 84,000 eons or whatever, the full scope. This is human experience. And of course, that set of human experiences that you see there is equivalent to the various potential possibilities of rebirth. It is the same thing. Rebirth is just really a new experience. That's what it is. When you get reborn from one life to another one, there is an abrupt change in your experience. That is the meaning of rebirth, an abrupt change in experience. Just like we change small things in this life, it is more abrupt when you go from one life to the next one. So once you have a full understanding of all human experience, then again, you can make this decision, adinava, asada, nisarana. The gratification, the positive side, the negative side, and the escape. So loka vidu can be understood in these ways. And of course, this is fundamental to what the Buddha's idea is about, understanding happiness and suffering. All of Buddhism is about this. And once we can approach that question properly, really understand this, that is what the Buddha is about. This is the gift of the Buddha to the world. Understanding happiness and suffering, which no one really does. No one understands these things. We are trapped by our ignorance, not understanding what to pursue, what not to pursue. Any questions about this so far? Please feel free to fire away at any point. And yes, please, Vincent.
Knower of the mind or the cycle of life, can you translate that into...
You could, but the thing is that, the word loka has a very clear, has a meaning in Pali. It means world. Yeah, that's what it actually means. But you can interpret it in that way. I think sometimes it's important to distinguish between translation and interpretation. So usually what happens is that you translate it as knower of the world, and then you have a footnote which refers you to the Rohitasa Sutta. And in the Rohitasa Sutta, they said, well, the world actually is personal experience, right? So you do something like that, and you get both the right translation and the kind of comment, yeah, as well at the same time. So that's kind of, I think, you usually how you would do it, yeah. All right. And if there are questions coming in online as well, we can take them as we go along, if you like. Yeah, that would be fine. So that is... Look, can we do... Okay, thank you. Are you happy to run back and forth? Yeah? Okay, great. Yeah. All right, so I'm not going to go through that question yet, because it's maybe a little bit on the side of what we're discussing, but I'll come back to all these questions later on. So the Buddha is Loka Vidu. Yeah, then we have the next one here, which is he is the supreme guide for those who wish to train. Yeah, this is the Anuttaro Buddhisadhamma Sarati. Yeah, you can see it over there. And so this is the idea that the Buddha is the supreme teacher. Yeah, Purisa, Anuttaro means unsurpassed, and Purisa means man or person. Here I think person is probably a preferable translation, because just like in English, man tends to mean person very often, in the same way in Pali. And Dhamma means... it means tameable. Quite literally, it means tameable. Yeah, so tameable people. So he's the unsurpassed. And then Sarati actually means something like charioteer, but charioteer in the sense of being a trainer. Yeah, someone who trains a horse in the chariot riding and these kind of things. Yeah? So he's the unsurpassed charioteer of tameable people. Huh? Yeah, that's kind of one of the epithets of the Buddha. Huh? Unsurpassed charioteer of tameable people, or unsurpassed trainer of tameable people. So what does this mean? Well, tameable, first of all, the idea here is that to be tameable, you have to kind of have an interest in Buddhism, right? You have to have an interest in these teachings. If you think Buddhism is nonsense, or the Dhamma is nonsense, or the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, then you're not going to be tameable. You're outside of this kind of scope. Buddha can't do much for you if you don't have that basic right view or basic wise attention with you. Without that basic wise attention, you're not going to go anywhere. So it's only if you are tameable. So we have to make ourselves as tameable as possible. The more tameable we are, the more power the Buddhist teaching will have to transform our lives. And the way that we make ourselves tameable is basically by establishing right view. Yeah, the more right view we have, the more, the fewer our defilements are, and all of these kind of things, we create a tameable personality which kind of leaps towards these teachings, take an interest in them, and actually practices them, not just now and again, but pretty much all the time, because we understand how important it is. Yeah, always reflecting, always using our perceptions to align them more with the way the Buddha taught. That is kind of the tameable personality. And so what does it mean that the Buddha is the unsurpassed trainer of tameable people? Why is he unsurpassed? Why is he a trainer? What is it about the Buddha? And of course, one of the reasons why he is unsurpassed is that part of the awakening experience of the Buddha, we know that when the Buddha awakened, he awakened to the Four Noble Truths, right? Dukkha, Samudaya, Nirodha, and Magga. Dukkha, suffering, Samudaya, origin of suffering, Nirodha, cessation of suffering, and Magga, the path that leads to the end of suffering. Yeah, the Four Noble Truths. And you can see there that one of the insights the Buddha had was into the path. Yeah, so understanding the path is part of the Buddha's insight. How is that possible? How can you have insight into a path? Because it's kind of, okay, you can maybe have insight into suffering, yeah, because you see, you can feel suffering, you can see that you have gone away from suffering, and now because you have gone away, you have ended it, you get a perspective on suffering, you're like the frog coming out of the water, you can see what suffering is. We can see that maybe the end of suffering, because you have given up something and it's all gone. Maybe the origin, because maybe you understand something about causality, but the path is maybe a little bit harder to understand. I think the one answer to that question is that when you come to the end of the path, like the Buddha, you also understand what kind of mind state it takes to see things clearly, to have insight. Because you have been through the path, you know the mind state it takes. And of course, the mind state that it takes to see things clearly is a mind that is completely pure of defilements. Not only is it pure of defilements, but it is fortified by the awakening factors. The awakening factors strengthen the mind. Yeah, it makes it imperturbable, as it says in the suttas. It cannot be shaken. It cannot be disturbed anymore. So it has that power and ability to see things in the right way. So the Buddha knows that the mind that can see things as they actually are is a mind that is completely pure and is fortified by this powerful awakening factor, the Satta Sambojanga, seven factors of awakening. Yeah, this is what actually makes this part. Part of the understanding. And that then combined with right view. Yeah, the right view is also incredibly important, because without that right view, you're going to get stuck in those deep states of samadhi. So that is what the Buddha sees as the path. And when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, that is exactly what you see. Yeah, the Noble Eightfold Path is really, it starts with right view. And from that right view, there's a gradual sequence of purification. That's really what it is. It is really, if anything is the path of purification, it is the Noble Eightfold Path. So I think the Visuddhimagga, the kind of other path of purification, is really named after the Noble Eightfold Path, I reckon. Yeah, Visuddhimagga, path of purification. That is what the Noble Eightfold Path is, a gradual sequence of purifying yourself until you reach complete purity. That is where these insights become possible. So this is what the Buddha sees. Yeah. So this is why he becomes the unsurpassed teacher, because he knows exactly what is required to reach that goal through his own experience. But there's another thing which is interesting about the Buddha, which always kind of fascinated me about the Buddha, and that are the kind of some of the two main qualities of the Buddha that explains to us why he is the unsurpassed teacher. And these two qualities are his wisdom on the one hand and his compassion on the other hand. And you will notice that when the Buddha comes after his awakening experience, one of the very interesting things about the Buddhism in the suttas is that the Buddha is not motivated by compassion before his awakening. There's no motivation of compassion before his awakening. Before his awakening, he's motivated by the suffering of life. He sees old age. He sees, I was talking about that on Friday. This is what the Buddha saw before his awakening. This is simple, really simple things, but very powerful. He saw old age. He saw illness. He saw death. He saw rebirth, to some extent. He saw defilements in beings. He saw sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He saw the problems of the world, the problems in his own life. And then he set out on the noble search, giving up the ignoble search, which is he searching for these things, even though all other people already have the problem, and then searching for more of that in your own life. He then decides to go for the noble search, which is finding an end to these things. So this is what motivated the Buddha to start looking for a solution to the dukkha, the problems of life, not compassion, as later Buddhism will have it, motivated by compassion to save everyone in the world. Because how can you have compassion? You don't even know if there is an answer. You have no idea what's going on. How can you start with compassion? It's starting in the wrong end. Once you have found the answer, then compassion arises, because now you can actually help people. And so this is one of the things you find in the same sutta, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26. It's one of the beautiful suttas in the Pali Canon, really, really inspiring. And the Buddha then comes after his awakening and he says, okay, are there anyone in the world that can understand these teachings? These are really profound. Is anyone able to understand this? It was just barely I was able to see these things, even though, the Buddha had very powerful spiritual faculties. Am I wasting my time trying to teach all these people walking in darkness in the world? This kind of deluded... No, I don't think he thought that, because the Buddha wasn't like that. But he had compassion, but he understood how difficult it is. And so then he uses the eye of the Buddha, and he surveys the world, and he looks at what is going on, and he sees that there are people in the world with little dust in their eyes. Aparajika, aparajaka, little dust in their eyes. So he knows that, and because of that, and also he says that there are people in the world who see fear, danger in the idea of rebirth, in the idea of continued samsaric existence. Yeah, and because of that, he says, yeah, well, there is hope for the world, if that's the case. Yeah, people are ready. People may be able to understand this. Then compassion arises in the Buddha. Then he goes out to teach the world. But you will notice the Buddha was hesitant. He didn't want to do it because he knew it was going to be hard work. Yeah, the Buddha, like everyone else, probably preferred just to chillax, yeah, sit in a nice cave somewhere, cool cave, enter the four jhanas and just chill, and then eventually die. Yeah? And that kind of, when he dies, highest happiness. Yeah? So the Buddha, and this is one of the points I would like to make, the Buddha had a negative vested interest in teaching here. Yeah? Most teachers have a vested interest, yeah, because you get a salary here. Yeah? Maybe you get some disciples. Maybe the disciples give you nice things. I have a vested interest because I always get nice coffee when I come here to Dhammaloka Center. Talata always offers me coffee. It's really, really sweet. And so I have a vested interest. This is the secret. Don't tell anyone this is the secret reason why I come here. So no, that's not actually true at all. But it's very nice that we can support each other in this way here. But... But the Buddha has no vested interest. For the Buddha, it is a hassle to teach the world. Yeah, far easier, far more pleasurable for the Buddha just to kind of enjoy the incredibly high blisses of the jhanas and the awakening experiences. That is what the Buddha really would like to do. Except that he sees he has the solution to the problem of the world. Then compassion arises. Then he does teach, even though he knows it's going to be sometimes painful. Sometimes he's going to have to argue with people. He's going to get into debates. He's going to have to do all of this stressful. I don't think it's very stressful for the Buddha, but it's still more stressful than just sitting in a cave and meditating. Yeah? So this is what I mean by negative vested interest. And that is very interesting, because once you understand that there is this negative vested interest, then you understand that the word of the Buddha is pure. Completely pure. He doesn't say anything to gain disciples. He doesn't say anything for any dodgy, ulterior motive that has nothing to do with the Dhamma. Every word he utters comes from purity because he wants to help. So when you start to read the suttas in that way, that every word is spoken by the Buddha because he has compassion for us. No other reason. There's nothing in the suttas that dilutes or makes the message impure in any way whatsoever. Once you get that, it means that you read the suttas in a new way. You think, wow, he's doing this out of compassion for us. Whoa, I better listen carefully here. Because this is purely done out of compassion for no other reason. He had a negative vested interest in teaching these things. So this is the one side of the Buddha, the compassion. And the other side, of course, the compassion arises because he knows he has the solution. He sees the suffering of the world. He sees the problems of humanity. He sees what is going on. He has the solution. Of course, that's his wisdom. That's the wisdom faculty. He has the highest solution. He knows that the gods in the heavenly realm, they don't actually have any solution at all. They may be glorious, they may be beautiful, they may be fabulously full, powerful in all kinds of ways, but they are still deluded. They think there is a self. They think that there is some happiness to be had somewhere. No, the Buddha has the answer. This is where the answer is. He has the highest wisdom in the universe, regardless of what other beings that might exist. Compassion and wisdom, very, very powerful combination. And in one way, this kind of summarizes who the Buddha was as a teacher. This is what makes him the unsurpassed teacher. This is what makes him so powerful as a person in this world. He's an ordinary human being, starting out, becomes the Buddha. He's probably, you can't call him an ordinary human being anymore, but you can still relate to him as a human being, yeah? Just like you can relate to someone like Ajahn Brahm or whatever. And then you're starting to get an idea what the Buddha is about, why he is the unsurpassed teacher of tameable people. Okay. Then we have the next little phrase here. Teacher of gods and humans. Satta deva manusanang. You can see over there. Deva, these are gods. Manusa are people. Teacher of gods and humans. And it's important here to understand what the Buddha means, what we mean by gods. Yeah? Gods in Buddhism does not mean kind of creator gods or anything like that. It's very different from the Christian gods. The gods in Buddhism are more like the Greek gods, yeah? Or the Nordic gods. You know the Nordic gods? Yeah? Thor and Odin, these are my relatives in Norway. You have the Roman gods, what they call Jupiter and whatever. And then you have every culture around the world has these gods. And ancient India was exactly the same. They had Sakka, they had Varuna, they had Vishnu, they had Shiva. And these gods are ancient. Yeah, they go back and back in time to long before the Buddha. If you go to Chinese culture, in China they have gods. Yeah, everywhere in the world they have gods. Gods are kind of part of the human reality, really. And you may think that these gods are just superstition, right? Well, I would say that, and this is kind of really hard to grasp maybe in the modern culture, but the real superstition is not these kind of gods. The real superstition, if there is any, is the idea of a creator god. That is the real problem. These kind of gods here actually fit in with the Buddhist worldview very well. Whereas the creator god, that is really the problematic one. And so I want to turn things upside down. It is the creator god which is a superstitious idea, not these kind of gods. It's kind of fascinating because this goes against very much of the cultural conditioning in the Western world, where we see the idea of a creator god as the pinnacle of the evolution of human thoughts. Yeah, human thought, we started out very early on. We started out when we kind of, you know, back in the Middle East. Yeah, that's where things started with European culture, started in the Middle East, and everyone had their gods. And over time, these gods kind of got amalgamated, yeah, and they got kind of reduced into fewer gods, and then everyone after a while had the same god. Ultimately, the Christian god emerged supreme. And so we think that there is an evolution here towards something more realistic. We're starting with some barbaric ideas. Yeah, everyone has their own god. That's really barbaric and simple. People just use this to explain the forces of nature, the lightning and these kind of things. And after a while, they understand, no, these are just forces of nature, no need for any god. Let's merge them all together. And they created the creator god. But there is some very serious problems with this, even though from kind of commonly viewed Western viewpoint, the creator god is the pinnacle of an evolution in the idea of God. And if you read a book, there's a book called The Evolution of God, I think it's called, by Karen Armstrong. She's one of those great scholars of religion. And she kind of plots out this change in the idea of God over time. But what is very interesting, and this is that if you take a god, yeah, that is a creator god of the universe, that exists outside of nature, exists outside of time and space, or has always been there eternally, such a god can never be experienced. Because eternity can never be experienced by a human being. Things outside of time and space can never be experienced by a human being. Something which is outside of nature can never be experienced by a human being. Something that created the universe can never be known by a human being. So when anyone has an experience and they call it a creator god, they are going beyond the data. There's no way you can experience such a being. And so the idea of a creator god must always be a figment of the human imagination. It must always be something that has been created by human beings. It cannot actually be known through human faculties, because human faculties are so limited. Whereas these kind of gods, yeah, the gods we are talking about here, and they are merely glorified human beings, right? They are just like us, basically. They eat, they fight a bit, especially the Nordic gods, they like to have a good fight. They drink, and then they get up again and fight some more. It's a crazy kind of idea of heaven, but anyway. And and they have lives, and then they have heartache, and the children don't behave. Once you start to read the suttas about the gods, they sound very much like human beings, especially the lower gods. Yeah, so these are the kind of gods that make sense, because they have lives like us. They have always have a limited lifespan. Yeah, so these are the gods that can be believed in, because they fit with what is experienceable in the universe. And so there is an unbridgeable chasm between the idea of gods, as we're talking about them here, and the idea of a creator god. There's an unbridgeable chasm. There is no way of bridging that gap. One is always going to be in the realm of speculation, whereas the other, at least, is potentially experienceable. So this is what the Buddha means by gods. But and because they are gods, because they are just glorified human beings, essentially, yeah, you go to heaven, one day you get reborn as a deva. I'm sure many people here will be reborn as a deva. Is that right? Why not? Yeah, I it's nice to be reborn as a deva, I reckon. You know, you can chill, you can have a bit of fun, you can enjoy yourself. There's nothing wrong with that. So one day you die, and then, whoop, you're a deva. Wow, I'm a deva now. Wow, this is cool, yeah? Now you're kind of lit, transparent, there's light coming out of you, you feel more powerful, you're more happy, yeah? All of these kind of things. But you realize it's still you, yeah? It's still you, you still have a limited lifespan, nothing has really changed all that much. And so one of the things to remember about these devas, precisely because they are really just glorified versions of human beings, they also have delusion. They don't understand what is going on, yeah? So even if you were to see the sight of a deva, yeah, imagine Sakka coming down to visit you one night, right? You think, wow, what is going on? It's this enormous light. You feel its power. Yeah, you feel like the world is coming to an end or something. Yeah. Maybe you think it's a UFO. I don't know what you will think it is. That's why some people say UFOs and devas might be the same thing. I don't know. But it's very easy to kind of fall to your knees and start praying, please save me, this must be the creator god, I'm giving up Buddhism straight away, I found the creator god, this is it. It's very easy to go there because it is such an unusual experience. But remember, you don't know what it is. Yeah, you have no idea what it is. It's just a light, it's just powerful. It doesn't mean that it is has any wisdom or anything like that. And this is kind of the point of the Buddha. We should not allow ourselves to be deluded by the fact that there are very powerful beings in this universe. Yes, we can be friendly to them, we can be nice to them, we can maybe they have some wise things to say, but we should not be drawn in by these things. This is why the Buddha has gone beyond all of this. He is teachers of gods and humans. And lo and behold, in the suttas you find the devas coming to the Buddha. Yeah, Sakka coming to the Buddha, the Sakkapanya Sutta, beautiful sutta. Sakka is very shy. It's very sweet. Yeah, Sakka, one of the most powerful beings imaginable. He's shy when it comes to coming down to the Buddha. Yeah, he says, "Oh yeah, Panchasika, my musician, you go and get the attention of the Buddha, because I people like me or devas like me, we can't just approach the Buddha." Yeah, so he sends down his attendant first of all, and then eventually he kind of comes down. It's very sweet, and then he becomes a stream entry during this discourse. So he's a disciple of the Buddha. So the Buddha is above all of this, right? The Buddha is the one with wisdom, not the devas, not other human beings. And this is what is kind of the point here. And of course, the point is also in that Indian society at that time, also maybe in society now, the point is that everyone believed in devas, everyone believed in gods, yeah? Everyone would kind of put out food to the gods, and they would pray to the gods, and this was what the Brahmanical culture was about supplicating the gods, making sure the gods were happy, the gods would look after you, all these kind of things. And then the Buddha says, no, wait a minute, I understand the gods don't understand me. There's a very powerful message here that the existing religion kind of falls in under Buddhism, yeah? And Buddhism is more like the umbrella religion that kind of covers all of that. And that's what I think Buddhism really is. It is like an umbrella religion in that sense. Even Thor and Odin, they have to kind of bow down to the Buddha. They don't want to do that because they want to fight, but they will do it when they have to. So the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. And one of the things that people often think. They think that the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and because he lived 2,500 years ago, he doesn't necessarily have any relevance, yeah, to modern society. How can the Buddha understand modern society? The Buddha taught people who were living in a very different culture at a very different time. And I want to say what I often say when I teach retreats and when I talk about this particular thing, because I think it's really important to understand and create that relationship with the Buddha. We've already made it clear that the Buddha was a human being before his awakening, yeah? And even afterwards, you could approach the Buddha like a human being. Yeah? This is one aspect of getting to a feel for the Buddha and getting the idea that he is approachable and we can have a relationship with the Buddha. But the other thing is actually to take the Buddha as your teacher. How can you do that? And the way to do that is to remember that when the Buddha taught audiences in ancient India 2,500 years ago, yeah, when he taught those people in that culture, he did not just teach the audience in front of him. It's such an important point, because the Buddha knew at that time that he was setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana, yeah? The setting in motion, the rolling out of the wheel of the Dhamma. And the idea of the rolling out of the wheel of the Dhamma is the idea that the Dhamma is such a powerful thing in the world that once you set it going by teaching the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana Sutta or teaching any of the other sutta, when people hear these things, they get so inspired, they get so fired up by the power of these teachings that they will pass them on from one generation to the next one, from one culture to the next one, going around the world. Yeah, that's why it is now in here in Australia. That's why it goes everywhere in the world. I don't know if there is anywhere where there is no Buddhism these days. I don't know, probably even in Antarctica, there are a few penguins practicing Buddhism right now. I'm not sure. We had to go down and check it out. Actually, there are human beings in Antarctica, so probably there, some of those are Buddhists. And so the Buddha knew that he was setting in motion something vast, something that was going to go on for a very long time. And because he knew that, he was not just teaching the audience in front of him. He was teaching all those people who would be listening to the Dhamma in the future, in Australia, in wherever in the world, right? Any culture, any place. And the reason why he can do that is because the human mind and the human heart is the same everywhere you go. It's a boring thing to say we're all the same, but we're all the same. Yeah, we want to be different because it's more interesting if we're a bit different. But actually, the difference between human beings are so superficial. The tiny bit of culture on top, yeah, and we kind of pretend that our culture is better than other cultures and our food is better than the other people's food, so because we have a slight bias in favor of our own culture. But it's only superficial. There's nothing really to it. Under the surface, we are the same. Pretty much the same psychology. We want the same things. We want to be happy. We want to avoid suffering. Yeah? We want to, have meaningful lives. And this is kind of human existence. It's the same for everyone. It doesn't make any difference. And this is what the Buddha recognized. So he knew it is possible if you pitch the teaching in the right way, everyone can understand. Everyone can gain an insight into these things. So this is the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. That's why when you open the suttas and you read them and you can recognize what is going on, especially when it's translated well, and it should be translated in such a way that you feel that you are in the presence of the Buddha, just like the Buddha taught people at that time and they were in his presence when that happened. In the same way, it should be taught. You should really feel, this is the Buddha talking to me, because the Buddha is actually talking to you. He's talking to every one of us here today. Because he made these things available in such a way that it would talk to humanity in general, regardless of who you are, whether you're a woman, whether you're a man, wherever you come from on this globe, it doesn't matter. It is for everyone. So remember that. The Buddha is your teacher, not just metaphorically. He's your teacher literally, because you have access to the suttas, you have access to his words right there. He thought about you. Yeah. He thought about you because he thought about everyone when he gave these teachings. And again, when you start thinking like that, when you read the suttas, this is the Buddha teaching me when he says these words. It means you take it much more seriously here. He's not teaching someone else. He's teaching you with his words. Yeah, he's coming from compassion. There's no vested interest. And he's teaching me. Okay, I better listen, right? It's like when you feel you are in the presence of someone extraordinarily powerful, when you feel you are in the presence of someone who really is wise, when you have a really good teacher, yeah, you really want to listen. You lend an ear because you have a feeling that you should be lending an ear. The Buddha is far wiser than that, far more powerful. So when you are in his presence, listen. So read the suttas in a new way. Read them as if the Buddha is talking to you. Read them knowing that he's coming from compassion as he does this. Every word matters. Every word is important. Then you are starting to take the Buddha as your teacher. This is how this happens. So the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans, both in the past and now, and also for the future. Yeah, this is what all of this is about. There's one more thing I often say when I teach this particular passage, because it's such a beautiful passage, and I would have wanted to talk even much more about it, because I'm sure you can probably talk endlessly about these things. It's just your imagination that is the limit, and unfortunately my imagination is way too limited. I wish I was much more, could just fire, go on about this for a long time, because it's such a beautiful thing. Yeah, you really start to get a feeling for the Buddha when you start to see things in this way. One of the other things I would really recommend you to do sometimes, to make yourself more a disciple of the Buddha, is to just reflect what it would feel like to meet the Buddha. Imagine that you're meeting the Buddha. What would that feel like to meet the Buddha? And if you think about it in the right way, initially you might feel a bit nervous. I don't know, first time you came into Dhammaloka Center, maybe you were a bit nervous. Those of you who were born in Buddhist countries, you probably, because you came as babies, you know, you are probably relaxed with it. But I know when I first came to a Buddhist monastery, I was like really nervous. I looked at these weird monks and I kind of wondering what was going on. I was attracted and repelled at the same time. Yeah, it was like this push-pull situation. I think many people who are not born Buddhists feel a bit nervous about that. And maybe even Buddhists as well, yeah? One thing is to go to the local temple, another thing is to meet the Buddha. Yeah, that is more, especially if you are born Buddhist. You've heard all of those stories, the Jataka stories, the Jataka Nidana, the origin story about all the kind of Buddha, and he's so magnificent that meeting someone like that is like, whoa, this is scary. Yeah? So this is why we try to make the Buddha, put him on the right kind of pedestal, so we understand who he is. So initially you are nervous, but then you approach the Buddha. The Buddha is probably sitting at the root of a tree. Sitting at the root of a tree, you know that he's in the forest there. So you walk into the forest. This is a man with an enormous reputation, the most powerful spiritual teacher in recorded human history. There's no one like the Buddha. And that's what you feel, but you don't know exactly what that means, right? That's why you are nervous. What does it mean that someone is so powerful? It's kind of scary. The power overwhelms you. And so you approach. And then eventually you catch a sight of the Buddha at the root of the tree. And he looks pretty much like a monk. He looks like an Indian man in India. He has, looks like... he has robes, maybe a little bit like what I'm wearing, not quite like this. He has a shaven head. And then when you see him, what you see this very peaceful person sitting at the root of a tree. One of the most powerful and important qualities of the Buddha is how peaceful he is. There's no agitation. There's a very profound sense of peace. And there's also a sense of benevolence with the Buddha, a sense of something you don't have to be afraid of at all. There's no need to be afraid of a person like this. And as you start to see this, your anxiety, agitation, whatever it might be, starts to go down. You feel more peaceful. And the closer you get to the Buddha, the more peaceful you feel, because there's an aura around someone like the Buddha of peace, of beauty, of benevolence, something very beautiful going on. And then you go up to the Buddha, and the Buddha talks to you. Lo and behold, the Buddha is here. The Buddha says, please sit down. So you sit down, you're not really sure what to do, because it's kind of still a little bit scared maybe. So you just sit down, and then the Buddha asks you, why are you here? And then you say, oh, you know, I have this problem. Yeah, I've had an argument with my husband or wife. And it's kind of, you feel a bit sheepish. You come into the presence of this kind of wow person, and all you have is this kind of silly question about your husband and wife. But the power of the Buddha is that the Buddha, even though he knows what human beings are like, everyone has these kind of problems. And so he tells you, yeah, okay, oh, don't worry, this is kind of the way things are, yeah. You know, your wife or your husband, they don't really know what they're doing, yeah, they're trying their best. Just have compassion, because everyone is trapped in, in delusion or whatever, so don't worry, just be kind. And so the Buddha gives you a very simple teaching, yeah. And one of the signs that it is the Buddha who gives you a teaching, yeah, is that it is actually very simple. It is something you can understand. The Buddha knows the limits of your ability to understand. You are a simple person. It's the first time you come to hear about Buddhism. He's not going to teach you about dependent origination. He's going to tell you something very simple. And what matters is not what he teaches you. What matters is where it is coming from. It is how that teaching feels. It feels peaceful. It feels compassionate. It feels powerful in a way you have never really experienced before, even though he just says, be kind. I better be kind. Yeah, it goes in very deeply because of where it is coming from. Where it is coming from is far more important than actual words that come out. And so you listen to this, and you, at the end of this, you realize that you have just been through a life-changing experience. Something that has transformed you in a very powerful way. And when the Buddha is finished, there's only one thing that you want to do. You want to bow down. And the reason you want to bow down is because you have been in the presence of something extraordinary, something very benevolent, very kind, so compassionate, so wise. No ego. There's no ego there. It is painful to have to bow down to an ego, because if you bow down to an ego, it's like you're bowing down to something that might take advantage of you. But there's nothing like that. And when there is no ego, when all there is are beautiful Dhamma qualities, then it's easy to bow, yeah? Because you're just bowing to something that is not dangerous, but actually the other way around. And you know, by the very fact of bowing down, you are actually developing those qualities in yourself right there and then by bowing down to the Buddha. And you realize that the Buddha is not even the person in front of you. Because if the Buddha has no ego, it means that he doesn't identify anymore as a man or a woman. Yeah, that is kind of gone. He doesn't identify as an Indian or any other person. All identity is gone. So when all identity is gone, you're not actually bowing down to this person. You're bowing down to very powerful spiritual qualities. That is all you're bowing down to. And this is exactly the same thing that we try to do here at Dhammaloka Center. When you bow down to the Buddha statue here, it's the same thing here. You're bowing down to these spiritual qualities because that is what the Buddha is, and he is nothing apart from that. So you bow down, and you get up, and then you walk away. And this meeting with the Buddha leaves an incredibly powerful imprint on your mind. You will never forget this meeting. It is one of these what is the word I'm looking for here? Anyway, it leaves a powerful impact on your mind, something you will never forget, something you will carry with you for the rest of your life. And you know that because this person said, be kind, it has made an imprint on your mind, you will actually help you to be kind in the future. So when you read the suttas, remember this is the situation you are in. So when the Buddha says in the sutta that you should live a life of kindness, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right thought, in the same way as that person that approaches the Buddha in the real life, you are approaching the Buddha through the suttas. Take it incredibly seriously. This is a matter of the very meaning of life itself. Yeah, this is how important it is. Every time you have an opportunity to be kind, every time you have an opportunity to not do the bad thing, do the right thing, because it is so powerful. Then, when you think like this, when you enter the suttas, you are really starting to make a relationship with the Buddha as a teacher. That is when these teachings become really, really powerful and really can be life-transforming. So the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. Then I'll just finish off the last two words here. We can have a bit of questions afterwards. So then we have the word Buddha again, awakened, yeah? And so the Buddha is the awakened one. This is the same, basically, as Samma Sambuddha. It doesn't really add very much. And then we have the very last word on the end there, the Bhagava, which is here translated as blessed. And Bhagava, maybe the best translation for Bhagava is perhaps something like Lord. Yeah, Lord in the sense of, like in the Christians, you use the word Lord for God. And the Bhagava is often used in India for gods and for very advanced kind of spiritual people. Yeah, so Lord is very close to translation, but maybe it's too close to the Christian idea of God to really be useful. So blessed is another translation of this term. But it is a kind of standard term used for gods and advanced spiritual teachers. So I will stop there. Are there any questions or comments at this point? Prem, please.
Ajahn, the nine qualities of the Buddha explained in this or listed in this stanza. Yeah. Samma Sambuddha appears as the second quality, and as the eighth one, the one but the last, again Buddha.
Yeah.
Why would they have used it in two places if it is the same meaning? I have heard an interpretation, I don't know whether it is correct or not.
Yeah.
Buddha also means nature. And one of them is
nature.
Natural or something like that, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Okay.
The principles of nature.
Usually Dhamma means principle of nature, not Buddha, but anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So they were trying to say one is for the one who gained the knowledge by himself.
Yeah.
Without any help from anybody else. Mm. And the other one is the follower of the nature.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it is correct or...
Yeah, I guess that is the point. There's a slightly different emphasis. You know, the first one is the one who becomes a Buddha by himself, Sambuddha, the fully awakened one, in a sense. So that kind of gives one slant to the idea. And Buddha here, I don't know if it can be translated as nature, but awakened
natural.
Or enlightened, natural... Yeah, okay, I'm not sure about that one. But Dhamma is usually what means nature, yeah? Dhamma means lawfulness or
Dhamma,
naturalness.
Yeah.
But remember that one of these things, that this is also the way the Buddha is talking here is it is not just the word, it is about how it sounds, right? The Buddha is an oral culture. So when he expresses something, it has to kind of be a... something which sounds a bit like a verse. A verse has to sound right to be inspiring, right? And this sequence here is not just about the word, but also it has to be inspiring. And whether you then duplicate the words a little bit, if as long as the overall kind of message is inspiring, I think that is often the most important thing here. And that is maybe another reason why it is duplicated. It is not necessarily required that every word has a separate meaning here. Sometimes repetition is possible in this kind of context when it's an inspiring thing that is being spoken.
Thank you, Ajahn. Yeah. And can I ask another question on the context of gods?
Yeah.
Because the Buddha is a teacher of gods and humans.
Absolutely, yeah.
And are they bound by some physical dimension, spatial dimension, or are they outside the dimensions as we know of 3D or whatever location-wise? I have heard that in some sutras there are various planes of gods, based on the seniority or power or something like that.
Yeah.
So the location is not explained in any sutras, are they?
The location is here.
Here is where? In the planet of Earth? Or?
Right here. Remember, it is a parallel. It's like a parallel existence. So the fact that you can't see them is not because they are not here. It's just because that they are parallel. Like a ghost, sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. The ghosts are right here, right? The ghosts are part of our existence. If you read what the suttas say, they say that they talk about what they call Loka Dhatu, a world system. And the Loka Dhatu is... the Earth, or the four continents, Jambudipa and the kind of the continents around it, Uttarakuru and these kind of continents. So that's like the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, yeah. And each one, and this is like a solar system, right? Earth, Moon, and Sun. It sounds exactly like a solar system. And then each one of these Loka Dhatus, each one of these solar systems, they have human realm, animal realm, ghost realm, Devalokas, all the way up to Brahma. So they are part of the solar system. They're right here with us. And the reason you can't see them, the reason you can't interact with them is because it is it is constructed from a different kind of matter. It is constructed from more fine material things. Sometimes there is interaction. If your mind is very sensitive, you can see them with the mind's eye, but not with the physical eye. And that's why if you see a ghost, usually it will be with the mind's eye that you see the ghosts. Same thing with devas. So they are here, yeah? But they are also restricted because their world also has limits. So even though they are here, they are limited by other laws, yeah? Maybe not exactly the same laws that we have, but by other laws. There will be restrictions in space and time and what they can do and all of these kind of things. And the higher up you go, the hierarchy of devas, the less restrictions they will have, the more freedoms they will have. That is part of the power of being a deva, that you have more freedoms.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Ananda.
Thanks, Ajahn, for the great explanations. Thanks. Something related to what Prem asked also, I also have two questions, Ajahn. Mm-hmm. The first one that in that Brahma Mantanika Sutta, MN 49, mm-hmm. that deluded Brahma, who thought he was everlasting. So you mentioned about the creator God, and is it possible that someone like him, this like that Brahma who Buddha went and brought him down to his place and tamed him, sort of, that's the tame, isn't it? Buddha tamed that Brahma. Someone like that may have spoken to people like Alar Kalam or Uttakaram Putta and then gave the impression that I am everlasting. So could be this creator God that has come to this
Exactly. So whenever you have a God whispering in your ear that I am the creator God, don't believe it. that's the lesson here, you know. Don't believe everything you hear.
The second one is about the... You mentioned about the compassion and the wisdom, Ajahn. And you said during that explanation that Buddha's faculties are all utterly developed. And when it comes to the Buddha, that Saddha faculty or the Saddha Bala, that could we say that it is his Buddha's confidence in his own teaching and in his capacity to teach? Because it's different for us, and our confidence is in the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha. When it comes to Buddha's faculties of the Saddha, I was just thinking.
The Buddha talks about having Saddha before his awakening as well, you know?
Before awakening.
Yeah, and that would have been similar to what we have in that sense.
Yes.
And at that time, it would be a confidence, I guess, in the possibility of awakening or something like that. And then, of course, when he then does find the awakening, then the Saddha becomes confirmed, then the confidence becomes established and it becomes unshakable at that particular point. So that is very much similar to what we are trying to do. We have a certain degree of confidence in these teachings, and then as we go along and we see them work and we get some of the results, the confidence will increase, the faith will increase. And this is why in Buddhism, this is one of those other kind of strange things about Buddhism. Wisdom and confidence, or wisdom and faith, are two sides of the same coin. Yeah, they're not really separable. The more wisdom you have, the more faith you have. The more faith you have wisdom. They're not separated as they sometimes are elsewhere. They come together. So then when you have when the Buddha's full confidence, is because he has seen the teaching. He has seen the Dhamma or Nibbana, just like anyone else who has become an arahant. Then he has full confidence because he knows what's going on. That's the main thing. And of course, yes, he has confidence in his being a teacher as well.
So faith leading to wisdom.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Okay.
Could I share something that I've experienced? Because you said to have a relationship with the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Polonnaruwa and I've only been a Buddhist for 5 years. And my children and my husband is in the van and they asked me to go up and spend some time and come back quickly. Yeah. And when I went up the steps, you know, the moonstone, there was this Buddha statue. Only the feet are remaining. And when I touched it, I had so much compassion for the Buddha and his life. Yes. Initially like sadness, but then it was overwhelmingly, you can't describe it with one emotion, many emotions.
Mm.
So I circumambulated.
Yeah.
And every time I touched his feet, it felt like he was really there. Is that faith or is that?
Yeah, that's kind of one of those things, you know, that sometimes we kind of get in touch with something powerful, and it kind of brings up emotions or whatever. And that's kind of part of it, you know. So sometimes it's weird. Sometimes it's hard to pinpoint exactly why it happens at that time and place. But sometimes our mind is ready and whatever, and then it suddenly something happens. That's wonderful. Yeah, great. Yeah. Eddie.
Oh, Ajahn Brahmani.
Hello, Eddie.
Yeah, good. Coming back to what Prem says, you know.
Yeah.
About the Buddha's teaching and nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only last night, you know, I went through the old books which I read and underlined.
Mm.
Yeah. And I re-underlined again, you know. It says the Buddha's teaching is about human nature and following the path, the middle way, you know. Mm. Okay? Not too much and not too little, you know. Okay? If you deviate a little bit, that's okay, you know. If you deviate more, you know, then suffering comes.
Mm.
So I thought that's it, like well, it was, you know, I thought.
Yeah.
So I re-underlined.
Yeah, no, that I think that's the whole point. Yeah, I agree. The Buddha's teaching is about nature because we have to understand things according to reality. If you don't understand things as they are, you are going to make wrong decisions. So it's so important to see things clearly, you know. So absolutely, I would recommend not to deviate at all from the teaching if possible, you know, to minimize the deviation. The less you deviate, the more powerful the practice is going to be. But sometimes it is unavoidable that there's a bit of deviation. So, that's not middle way. That middle way is something else. It doesn't mean middle way that you can deviate a bit. It means middle way. Middle way means that you don't, you're not interested in the body, not interested in painful experiences, nor in indulging the body. That's the middle way. The middle way is the way of the mind, developing the mind. But not middle way cannot be applied in all circumstances. And if you apply it in the sense that, you know, it means that you deviate from the path a little bit, I think that is where you are probably applying it in not the correct way, I would say. Yeah. All right. So there is a few questions from online. So please come back in a second if you have some more questions. I will just do some of these from online first of all. Okay, so first of all, we have a message. I'll do the last one first because it's from Venerable Karunika. So hello, Venerable. Thank you so very much for this inspiring teaching on the Buddha's qualities. It's really powerful and uplifts my heart. Yay, well, that's the kind of message I like. So that's kind of great. So thank you very much for that wonderful contribution. So let me now go back to the other ones. I will start from the top. What were the early signs that the Buddha is actually awakening and going through in the right direction? Okay, so obviously the early signs, there are a number of signs in the suttas that can be used for this and can be used for looking at this particular point of view. One of them is what happened to the Buddha to be when he was in his household life, yeah? When he looked at the problems of the world, he looked at death, he looked at old age and illness, and he saw that there was a problem, and he turned away from the five-sense world. He realized that the five-sense world was really problematic, because all of these things with old age, death, corruption, all of these things exist more than anywhere else in the five-sense world. So that was the first kind of insight, turning away from that five-sense world. The second insight of the Buddha was when he started practicing his ascetic practices, because the ascetic practices are often used to overcome the five-sense world and overcome the problems in that world, right? And then he realized that ascetic practice does not actually overcome that. And that's where we come back to the middle way again, Eddie, yeah? The idea that the five-sense world is problematic because that makes the body, the five-sense world, the five senses important, On the other hand, if you torture the body, you have a similar kind of problem. The body becomes important. You can't really let go of it. And so he realized there must be another way. And this was one of the great breakthroughs of the Buddha, was when he realized this doesn't work. And then he reflected, could there be another path? And he realized the other path is the path of jhana practice, of samadhi. That is the way. That is actually maybe the one really powerful breakthrough that was required by the Buddha. And once he had seen that, then he carried on and he kind of went through what is known as the Te Vidya, the three knowledges, recollecting past lives, understanding karma, and then finally the awakening experience at the end of all of that. So that gives you a little bit of idea of what, of how the Buddha's awakening and going in the right direction, how that happened. Second question, regarding the Buddha being the supreme teacher, is it possible an arahant after the Buddha is a better teacher? I'm thinking of saying standing on the shoulder of giants. I think that I don't really think you can get better than the Buddha. I think that is problematic, because one of the things about the Buddha is that it takes an extraordinarily powerful spiritual qualities to be able to find your way through samsara without a teacher. And this is what kind of what is unique about the Buddha, this ability to find his way without a teacher, right? For most of us, we practice this path. We have a teacher. We have the best teacher in the world. Still, it is difficult. So the fact that someone is able to do this without a teacher is just really extraordinary. And so what that means is that he had qualities that enabled him, I think, to practice or to present the Dhamma in also a very powerful way because of those powerful spiritual abilities that he had. But I do think, and I think you are right in one sense, I think that the Buddha, I think we also need other teachers, because sometimes we need teachers to draw out some of the meaning of what the Buddha had. We need teachers who had similar kind of experiences who can understand what the Buddha was saying. There is a lot of disagreement in the world of Buddhism about what the Buddha actually taught. And this is one of the problems, right? So one of the ways of settling those disputes is to find someone who maybe have the similar kind of insight, as someone with a very impressive spiritual qualities. They will then teach you what the suttas say, and then you have greater access to what is going on. So there is a little bit of this mixture between having the ancient scriptures of the Buddha available and also having the living example right here, right now. When those two things come together, it becomes a bit like dynamite. Living example plus ancient scriptures is a very powerful combination here. Okay, we have a message from Bulgaria. Is the universe matter and antimatter mind-made? Condition created by the interacting outflowings of the mind, or antimatter is nature balancing itself and only matter is mind-made? Is the universe mind-made? I think this is really not possible to answer from the suttas. All we can say is that my world, the world that matters, which is our inner world, that is what we mean by the world. This is where happiness and suffering is. This is where we experience everything. Everything happens within us. What is out there, we don't have no idea what it is, if there is anything here. So I would say that's a question that the Buddha doesn't really answer, whether there is a world apart from minds. Don't know the answer to that. That's kind of the answer. And I would say that this is where we are going into the realm of speculation. And one of the things we have to be very careful with is to speculate too much or philosophize too much, because philosophizing has been the downfall of Buddhism for 2,500 years, starting with the Abhidhamma and starting with all kind of arguments and discussions and various schools breaking up. All of it, really, or large part of it, because of philosophizing. That has been a very important problem. So I think this we are veering too far into that area, really. So I think we're going to have to put that one to one side. Okay, next question. Ajahn, a comment. Isn't it such good fortune that many in India at the time, including Prince Siddhartha, knew there could be a way out, unlike the majority of people at all times who just live, enjoy, suffer, pass away, thinking there will be heaven or hell after? Yes, I really agree with you. I think the ancient Indian society was a very interesting society. Lots of spiritual practice going on. Even today, you go to India, it's a very religious kind of society. And people are always inquiring, people are very interested. I have speculated, it says in the suttas, that the Buddha is always born in Jambudipa, is always born in India. And I think that what it means that it takes a society similar to what you find in India to be able to give rise to a Buddha, because it needs qualities like that, where ascetics are encouraged to practice asceticism, where they are supported, where they are respected in society, where they already are spiritual practitioners who practice samadhi in a deep way, so that the jump you have to go to reach full awakening is fairly short. Much of the path has already been practiced by others. And so I think, to me, that is the meaning of India, is that it's that similar kind of society required for a Buddha to arise. So yes, I agree with you, and I think that is very inspiring to read about these things precisely for that reason. Okay, next question. Are there actually holy beings in Buddhism who can help us, or is that atheistic and avoiding a responsibility? A holy being in Buddhism just means someone who has insight into the Dhamma. Yeah, usually someone who is holy will be someone who is on the path of awakening, the four kinds of beings, yeah, the stream mentor, the once-returner, non-returner, and the arahant. And these would be considered holy. These are the kind of sugatos, if you like, that we saw before. And of course, they can help you, just like the Buddha can help you. So that is where you should look for holy beings. If you look to gods as holy beings, you are very likely to be led astray, because they don't know the Dhamma any more than human beings do, unless they are Aryas, unless they are noble ones. Of course, one of the great things about being reborn in the Tabatingsa heaven is that the god, the head of Tabatingsa, supposedly is a stream enterer. Yeah? So it's kind of really nice to have a possible stream enterer as the leader of a whole realm. That's kind of cool. Okay, so then we have a message from Santuti. Really? Okay. Hello, Venerable. That's really cool. So inspiring, hearing Maharaj talking about the Buddha. Thanks so much. Wow. That is very nice to hear my fellow monastics, two fellow monastics, listening and being inspired. What a wonderful thing that is. Do we have any more questions before we call it a day? Eddie, yeah, please.
Ajahn Brahmani, yeah. I like what you just said, you know, a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
You said about the Buddha's teaching and also dealing with the current situation, you know. That leads to dynamism, you know.
Yeah.
That's a very powerful thing, you know. I just share something, okay?
Yeah.
That's from BGF, okay? Yeah. Yeah. It says that during the Buddha's time, you know, he was walking, you know, past a household, you see. And this person in the house asked him, you know, hey, you, come in. Ask the Buddha to come in. So the Buddha went in. When the Buddha was in, he says, no, get out. Buddha was out, you know. This happened three times, you know. The third time, when Buddha was out, he asked him to come in. The Buddha says, I'm not coming in this thing, okay? And gave him some lecture, and the Buddha went away, you know.
Yeah.
The gist is that use your own discretion. You understand? Buddhism, you can be very passive, you see, but we have to use our own discretion to deal with things. What you say that, you know, like a teaching and your own inner situation, you have to deal with your own. You see what I mean?
Yeah. So you're saying that you shouldn't just be
a fool or what?
A fool and just passive, and you should sometimes you have to be a bit assertive, and you have to stand your ground. Yeah, I agree. That actually is from the Sanghita Nikaya, that story. It's about a yakka who is living in a cave, and he says to the Buddha, come in, go out. And then the Buddha actually says, okay, enough of this coming and going. So it's right there.
I always deal with that thing, you know, when I have a problem, deal with something. Thank you very much.
I agree with that. I think that's a very important point to make, actually, because it's often forgotten in Buddhist circles. People think that as a Buddhist, you're always supposed to be nice. You cannot be assertive or stand your ground. But that's actually not true. Sometimes it is appropriate to stand your ground. We should be kind and compassionate, but also know when we are being abused, or being misused in whatever way, and then it's much better to just say stop, and I'm not going to go with that. So absolutely, that's an important point.
Thank you.
All right. Everyone else is happy? Yeah, okay. Okay, very good. That was we didn't get very far today, but sometimes it's nice to stay with something for a while. So let's do the respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.